Thank you very much. Can you all hear me okay? Yes, good. Right. I'm going to be talking today about something very specific in relation to Dalí. Very specific but frustratingly complicated. And it revolves in particular around this object here by Dalí from 1931, a so-called symbolically functioning object, of which much more later. And you'll have spotted as well a thinly veiled allusion to Freud's founding text, the question of lay analysis, which is going to play a part in this as well as we go. So amongst the many expressions of surrealist practice, both in terms of text and visual arts, that have especially interested audiences in the last 10 or 15 years, I'd say, is the idea of the object, both in terms of surrealist collecting practices, the notion of the found object, and the surrealist object, the specifically created assemblage made out of deliberately diverse and even contradictory materials that begin to come together in the 1930s in particular and culminate at the end of the 1930s in the major international exhibition in 1938 in Paris, which in a sense is both an invitation to the viewer to walk into a kind of a materialized dream environment and is a sort of gigantic surrealist object in its own right within which one can dwell and explore. So this engagement with the object is very much a kind of quintessential expression of surrealism at its height, at the height of its public visibility during the 1930s. And it's one of the ways in which surrealism attempted to engage in a very specific and direct and actual way in the relationships and exchanges between the unconscious and poetic functions of the psyche and the material conditions of the everyday world. And the fact that this emerges in the 1930s is precisely one of the ways in which the public engagement of surrealism, the moment when it really becomes kind of big news in terms of the public on both sides of the Atlantic, is, I think, not a coincidence. And many of these surrealist objects you'll see here, Merit Oppenheim's Fur Capsules and Spoon, are precisely amongst the most iconic works of surrealism from this period. As we're going to see, the theme of the object in relation to the unconscious specifically is actually present from surrealism's inception in 1924. And here I'm going to focus on one particular moment, which is precisely that where the vogue for creating and exhibiting objects, but also for considering them as interpretative tools, begins from the moment of kind of Dalí's thinking around the surrealist object, around the period 1930 to 31. We've already heard in one or two cases that this particular moment is significant for Dalí and for surrealism. So I want to present this as a kind of intersection of a surrealist concern with, on the one hand, a kind of materialist enigma of everyday objects. On the other, substantially, the idea of play and ludic strategies of alternate knowledge. And thirdly, the motif of analysis, an engagement with predominantly Freudian psychoanalysis that haunts the French surrealist group as both the point of origin of surrealism, but also as a strand of thought with which it's in tension. So the relationship between surrealism and Freud's work is not a straightforward one, and it's often one of conflict as well as agreement. The pieces of this puzzle are unruly, and in particular, I'm not a psychoanalyst, so I'm going to look forward to people's suggestions for improvements in this as we get further. Shall I move this? Just doing that. Is that okay? Right. The symbolically functioning object is a proposal that comes from Salvador Dalí to the surrealist group in Paris around the course of 1931, and it comes to fruition in an article of the same name, presented in the French journal Le Surrealisme au service de la Révolution, I'm going to call that SAS DLR from now on, if that's okay, in which he begins with listing all kinds of different types of surrealist objects that might potentially exist. At this point, most of them haven't yet been made, but in particular, beginning with this specific category of the symbolically functioning object. And the text that follows it begins both to introduce and to unpack one by one the five examples of symbolically functioning objects which he's presenting to the reader of the magazine. These objects, Dalí writes, which lend themselves to a minimum of mechanical functioning, are based on the phantasms and representations likely to be provoked by the realization of unconscious acts. In a nutshell, what he's doing, what he's inviting the participants in this game to do, is to pull together an assemblage of unexpected, very diverse objects very much in the same way that a Surrealist automatic text might pile together different ideas, different rhythms and notions and phrases without any particular forethought about what they might mean. And the second part of this process for Dali is then to bring those together and to interpret them. The particular moment of the beginning of the 1930s is a significant time for Dali to be doing this. Turning to the object is happening at a key moment for the French Surrealists. There have been complex crises of the period 1929 to 1930. There have been defections, disagreements, some bitter rivalries. And in particular, the idea of politics, of political engagement, and also complications around love relationships are some of the ways in which this is a particular moment of crisis for the French Surrealist group. Dali is a recent recruit to this group and is also something of a rising star. And so it's to Dali in particular that the group turned in order to suggest some new directions for the group to take in terms of its collective thinking but also its collective action. The idea of the object is a good one from this perspective because it lends itself precisely to the idea of action, of materialist interventions, and helps to, in a way, guard the Surrealist group against the accusations of idealism and of dilettantism that they're being subjected to in this period from all sides. René Crevel, the Surrealist poet, writing in 1931, round about the time of the making of these objects, specifically cites Engels' critique of philosophy's tendency in the previous four centuries to compartmentalise phenomena into distinct categories. Quoting Engels, he says, "This method has left us the tendency to study objects and natural phenomena in isolation, outside of the reciprocal relations that bring them into a whole, and to envisage objects not in their movement but in their stasis, not as essentially variable but as essentially constant, not in their life but in their death." So this notion of thinking about objects in interrelationship and in mobility are going to be key here. In fact, the fascination with the object has been present in the Surrealist group right from its very early period, and even arguably from its prehistory in Paris Dada. One thinks of the objects of Marcel Duchamp and Man Ray. And as early as 1926, the Surrealist journal La Révolution Surréaliste announces a forthcoming exhibition and catalogue of Surrealist objects, which never takes place. We'd also want to note, I'm sorry that there's missing a bit of text down there for the captions. It's also the case that given the origins of French Surrealism from an encounter with Freudian psychoanalysis, it's not surprising that the idea of the object as it emerges in early Surrealist practice is also repeatedly celebrated under the auspices of the unconscious and in particular in dreams. And the paintings of Giorgio de Chirico, which slightly predate French Surrealism, are typical of this, for example. So this idea of a coming together of enigmatic objects in an unexpected formulation that is precisely heralded in under the auspices of dream. André Breton's, who's the leading theorist of Surrealism in this period, writes in another text that kind of is around about the same date as the First Manifesto, the introduction to the discourse on the paucity of reality. He writes, "It should be realised that only our belief in a certain necessity prevents us from granting poetic testimony the same credence we give to an explorer's story. It's why I recently suggested that as far as it's feasible, one should manufacture some of the articles one meets only in dreams, articles which are as hard to justify on the grounds of utility as that of pleasure. The other night during sleep, I found myself at an open market in the neighbourhood of Saint-Malo and came across a rather unusual book. Its back consisted of a wooden gnome whose Assyrian beard reached to its feet. Although the statuette was of normal thickness, there was no difficulty in turning the book's pages, the thick black wool. I hastened to buy it, and when I woke up, I was sorry not to find it beside me. It'd be comparatively easy to manufacture it. Thereby, I may assist in demolishing the thoroughly hateful trophies of the concrete and add to the discredit of rational people in things." And this idea of the interpenetration of dream and everyday life is a focus for Breton, and in particular his book Communicating Vessels, written in the 1930s, and which again emerges from the same kind of context and the same background of debates and discussions that the symbolically functioning objects also appear. But as we've already heard a few times today, the relationship between Surrealism and Freudian psychoanalysis is far from straightforward. They both agree about the existence of the unconscious, the primacy of its functions, and the immense significance of its discovery. And the status of dream is paramount not only for psychoanalysis, but also for early Surrealism. So much for the psycho, but what about the analysis? The idea of analysis for surrealism is fraught for three broad reasons, I think. Firstly, that the mechanical association of manifest ideas or images with correct readings of latent meanings is problematic and might lead to a very reductive image of this equals that. Secondly, of course, the surrealists don't share Freud's clinical imperative. On the contrary, they're tempted to extol dysfunction and madness. They use and they misappropriate Freudian science as they see fit. And thirdly, unlike Freud, for them, it's the manifest that's more interesting than the latent in many cases. And this relationship between the latent and the manifest and their relative values is one of the core ways in which differences and tensions between surrealism and psychoanalysis are engaged. We notice, for instance, Freud writing to André Botton in 1937, declining the invitation to submit a dream to a published anthology. And Freud writes, "That which I call the manifest dream is not of interest to me. I deal with the search for the latent dream content, which one can extract from the manifest dream by analytical interpretation. A collection of dreams without associations says nothing to me." Nevertheless, from the outset, the French Surrealist group repeatedly engaged in collective games, especially group inquiries, in which expression of poetic, irrational associations and interventions are precisely brought together and analysed in quite significant detail. And there are a number of inquiries during the 1920s and 1930s into topics such as love, sexuality, the city, and the object in particular. These activities, these attempts at kind of irrational analysis, are part of the surrealist mode of social and philosophical speculation, but they're also first and foremost games. They are playful. And the significance of the ludic qualities can't be underestimated for the surrealist group right through its existence. So games are collective, they're collaborative, they're interactive, they are free of external ties, but they're also convivial. They link to the sovereign values of childhood, but also to a kind of non-normative, unruly aspect of life. They're organic, they're generative, they're liable to create new logics. This link between play and analysis might suggest that that surrealism's interest in psychoanalysis is somehow of a rather kind of flippant or tentative type. And certainly the relationship between Freud and Breton, the disagreements that kick off right from the word go, certainly suggests that it's going to be difficult to establish a clear dialogue. But we'd also want to note the specific ties with psychoanalysis that are taking place within the French surrealist group in the 1920s. A good example of this might be the presence of a French psychoanalyst, Jean-François Wittmann, a psychoanalyst whose background was as a practicing artist, was a friend of Freud, but also closely linked to the French surrealist group, interested in the relationship between art and psychoanalysis, and he publishes in all the major journals, surrealist journals of the 20s and 30s. He was a friend of the Dada poet and friend of the surrealist Jacques Rigaud, for instance, and he, amongst other things, he reviewed Freud's works on jokes and the relation to the unconscious in SAS DLR number 2, 1931, the issue that precedes the objects. So the surrealist community is well informed, not just by readings, but by direct encounters. What's even more telling is that there's a translation of a major section of Freud's essay, The Question of Lay Analysis, first published in La Révolution Surréaliste in October 1927, the whole of parts 2 and 3. And, of course, this essay examines the matter of non-specialist analysis, and it does so in lay terms. So it's safe to assume that Dalí knew this text well, just as he'd known many other works by Dalí. The Question of Lay Analysis is written in the form of a conversation, which is already liable to interest the surrealists. And it also goes straight to the heart of the question of whether or not analysis is something that should be undertaken by non-medical individuals, something that Freud specifically notes in his introduction is prohibited by law in France. So this, I would argue, heads towards the idea of the surrealists thinking about the legitimacy of their own status as a kind of both playful community but also an analytical one. The dawn of the 1930s is a moment of attempting to reconcile Marxist and Freudian trends within philosophy. And this is true not only in the French surrealist group, but also amongst surrealists in Serbia and in Romania at this point. And the symbolic functioning objects come, therefore, at a crucial juncture in terms of the French surrealist existence and their attempts to kind of put into place this perhaps impossible task of reconciling the two major strands of their interests, political, material, and interpersonal and psychic. André Breton asks André Thérion, the writer, and Dalí to bring together what Breton calls concrete proposals to be carried out immediately. And Thérion recalled, they tried to find some central points that would allow each surrealist to exercise his talent in a joint project anchored in mutually accepted discipline. Thérion went on to develop ideas around politics and anti-clerical activity, while Dalí turned to the object. Thérion went on, one of my concerns was to avoid letting our interest in psychoanalysis, in the relations between the conscious and the unconscious, slip towards the philosophical statement that our adversaries labelled idealist and would give substance to accusations of Freudianism. Dalí's proposal that the group start to think about making objects and analyse them navigates a complex line between acknowledging the Freudian origins of this idea of analysis and its values for surrealism, and an approach that also, as we're going to see, specifically reverses, or at the very least challenges, aspects of psychoanalytic orthodoxy. So Dalí's proposal, which was apparently discussed at length amongst the group in the early part of 1931, culminates in what I think is best seen as a kind of game in which participants offer the idea of assemblages made spontaneously without thinking directly about what it is they're going to do, making these objects, although it must have taken some time to actually construct them, and bearing in mind that some of the participants are not artists, this would have felt quite a complex, quite a challenging thing to do. The idea is that a kind of evocation of a materialization of desires, anxieties, or psychic processes might be kind of enacted through these objects. Dalí goes on to choose five of these works, which he illustrates in the journal article I've already talked about. And it's significant, perhaps, that I think, with the exception of Alberto Giacometti, who in other ways also fits into this rubric, the other four participants are all, in some respects, in complex and shifting emotional relationships to each other, as we'll see. So that while Dalí and Gala both produce objects, significantly the object by Gala is labelled Gala Éloire in the journal. She was still married at this point to Paul Éloire, even though she was already Dalí's partner. And the other two participants, André Breton and Valentin Hugo, were also in an attempted and ultimately failed relationship around about this time. I'm going to read a portion of Dalí's text, since arguably he says much better than I could exactly what his intentions are. So this is from his essay to accompany these works. Acts whose realization can't explain the pleasure thereby derived. Acts which can't be accounted for by erroneous theories elaborated by censorship and repression. In all the cases analysed, these acts correspond to clear and blatant erotic fantasies and desires. The incarnation of these desires, the way they objectify themselves through substitution and metaphor and are enacted symbolically, constitutes the process typical of sexual perversion, which resembles in every aspect the process of the poetic phenomenon. Even in the case when the desires and erotic fantasies at the origin of these objects are included in the common classifications of, quote-unquote, the normal, the object itself and the phantasms unleashed in its operation always constitute a new and absolutely unknown series of perversions and consequently of poetic phenomena. Surrealist objects are in their almost embryonic phase, but their analysis enables us to foresee all the violent fantasy of their continuing prenatal life. The culture of the mind, he ends up, culture of the mind will be one with the culture of desire. Now, in fact, the first of the objects that Giacometti presents for consideration under this rubric of symbolically functioning objects is a work that had been made some time previously, in early 1930. It was Alberto Giacometti's suspended ball, and I'll turn to Dalí's description of it. A ball of wood bearing a feminine hollow is suspended by a fine violin string above a crescent whose ridge lightly touches the cavity. The spectator finds himself instinctively forced to make the ball slide onto the ridge, something that the length of the string only partially allows to happen. Maurice Nadeau, who went on some time later to write an early history of surrealism, recounted in that history, everyone who's seen this object function has felt a violent and indefinable emotion, doubtless having some relation with unconscious sexual desires. This emotion has nothing to do with satisfaction, but rather with irritation, the kind provided by the disturbing perception of a lack. Dalí, however, pointed out that although this was the object which had first sparked his interest in the idea of the symbolically functioning object, and he'd seen it in the Galerie Pierre in 1930, he also insisted that it didn't quite fit his category because it did still remain at the level of sculpture. Giacometti's suspended ball, Dalí wrote, was an object which had already posited and combined all the essential principles of our definition, but is still limited to a sculptural means of action. Symbolically functioning objects leave no room for formal preoccupations. So Dalí's claim is that this can't be thought of properly as a symbolically functioning object with all of its kind of spontaneity and irrational, because it's been made deliberately, because sculpture takes some time to think about and create. In fact, when you look at Giacometti's working practices during this period, he clearly was using automatic and dream-inspired techniques in order to make his objects. He would, in an interview many years later, he would say, "For years, my sculptures would present themselves to my mind fully formed. Making them was practically a chore. I had to see them made, but their realization was irritating. It was essential that with the maquette being in plaster, a cabinet maker would execute them so that I could see them ready-made like a projection." So in other words, they conform to the automatic principles of this idea of a spontaneous assemblage of objects. One of the most complex readings of this work is by the art historian and theorist Rosalind Krauss, who in particular is arguing for this period of Giacometti's work in terms of the idea of play. So playfulness, but also a playfulness that combines threat and violence, is part of this. And at the same time, the idea of motion, of a mobile object, one that demands touch and intervention, is key to this. Sexuality and threat are clearly prominent in this work, unsettling the idea of what the function of the object is. And Krauss argues that it's the way that you can't really quite attribute a male or female character to the two main elements of the sculpture. So in other words, you can either say that the ball is male and the crescent female, or vice versa. So she ends up arguing that actually the machine itself, the sculpture itself, is a kind of machine for generating sense. The idea of an object as mechanism, of machinery, is something that we might actually make a link to Freud's question of lay analysis. Precisely in the section that appears in La Révolution Surréaliste is the passage where Freud argues, "We picture the unknown apparatus which serves the activities of the mind as being really like an instrument constructed of several parts, each of which performs a particular function and which have a fixed spatial relation to one another." The notion of a clear sexual motive and one anchored in notions of non-normative sexuality is clearly at the heart of Dalí's own object. The original, documented in the Journal of 1931, seems to have been lost, and its later versions, created in the 1970s, that we still have today, and there's about eight of these in existence. And we can see here from the original photograph that they're pretty much reproduce accurately the original. So, after all, if you're going to root your work in an idea of practice that's anchored in a knowledge of Freudian models of the psyche and of structures, it's hardly surprising that sexuality would arise. René Crevel emphasises the promiscuity of objects in this category of works, and in particular in Dalí's sculpture. The objects, Crevel argues, caress each other, they suck each other, they interpenetrate, in short, they make love. There's also something highly personal about this work, made clear in the marking for the re-edition of the object, of this as being specifically Gala's shoe. So I'm guessing that the original was probably Gala's shoe as well. Part of the problem of this object, from the point of view of analysis, is the sense that sexuality is not just prominent, it's the whole raison d'etre of the object. There's no room for chance or automatism. Analysis, in particular, seems to be redundant. So let's turn to Dalí again and quantify and enumerate these objects. A woman's shoe in which a glass of lukewarm milk has been placed in the middle of a ductile paste that is excremental in colour. The mechanism dips a sugar cube painted with the image of a shoe so as to observe the disintegration of the sugar cube and, as a consequence, the image of the shoe in the milk. Several accessories, pubic hairs stuck to a sugar cube, a small erotic photo, complete the object, which is accompanied by a spare box of sugar and a special spoon for stirring the grains of lead inside the shoe. And one would just note the particular motifs of things like the shoe and the spoon and milk are motifs that reappear repeatedly in Dalí's work around about this time. You probably can't see terribly well, but in the drawing on the right, behind the table, you can just see the shadowy figure of a man who is eating something from inside a shoe and holding a spoon. Of course, the issue here is whether one can straightforwardly analyse this object or see it as a kind of vehicle for interpretation. And as we've already heard referenced today, this morning, one of the essential difficulties of approaching Surrealist practice from the perspective of psychoanalysis is that one can't straightforwardly apply psychoanalytic analysis to Surrealist artefacts, because they are already, on the one hand, they are already made in full awareness of psychoanalytic texts and theories, and secondly, that they may more usefully be seen as, precisely in David Lohnes' words, actually, interpretative tools, rather than as objects of interpretation. So that relationship between latent and manifest functions here, which, as we've already seen, is the basis of part of the difficulty for Freud with Surrealist practice, is also going to be part of the way in which other Surrealists in the group have difficulties with these works. André Breton, writing in an essay which was reproduced immediately after Dalí's essay in SAS DLR, notes this. To judge from the symbolically functioning objects that I know, I think I can say, without expressing the slightest reservation on their explosive value or their beauty, that as one might have expected, they give rise to a less vast scope to interpretation than objects in this same vein that are less systematically determined. The voluntary incorporation of latent content, frozen in advance, into the manifest content has the effect of diminishing the tendency to dramatization and magnification that in the other cases censorship sovereignly adopts. In the end, no doubt, such objects, too specific and too personal in conception, will always lack the stunning power of suggestion with which certain almost normal objects are by chance endowed. Perhaps as much as Dalí's object, Breton was thinking about his own contribution to the game of symbolically functioning objects, one which right from the word go was... is clearly identified as the most complex and the most difficult, therefore, to really kind of understand and make work. Breton, who made several forays into visual practice, tended to be quite circumspect about the way in which he would present the works, and usually quite anxious about the outcome. So he was never quite comfortable with seeing himself as an artist. I'll enumerate some of the elements of Breton's work again using Dalí's words. Okay. The most complex and difficult to analyse. Atop a little bicycle saddle, there's a terracotta receptacle filled with tobacco, on the surface of which lie two long pink confections. They're sugared almonds, actually. A polished wooden sphere, which as it turns in the axis of the saddle, brings into contact the point of the latter with two antennae of orangish celluloid. The sphere is joined by two arms of the same substance to an hourglass laid horizontally, and a bicycle bell, which is supposed to go into action when a green confection is projected into the axis by means of a slingshot. The whole thing is mounted on a board covered with woodland vegetation, which in places reveals a paving of explosive caps, which I guess you put in toy guns, and of which a corner more dense than the others is occupied by a small book sculpted in alabaster, its cover decorated with a photograph under the glass of the Tower of Pisa, which next to which, brushing aside the foliage, one discovers a cap, the only one that's exploded beneath the hoof of a doe. Stephen Harris reads this object as an expression of a kind of fraught encounter of aggression and frustration. And certainly in terms of Breton's emotional life, this particular moment is one of particular trauma and crisis. He's just come out of a very difficult and at times very, very passionate but problematic relationship with a woman called Suzanne Musel, who was a significant influence on Breton's ideas and writings in this period. But that particular relationship is falling apart and has finally failed just at the moment when this object has been made. So that sense of kind of pleasure and anxiety or threat is found in all kinds of places. For example, in The Sugared Almond, which, as Harris points out, the French word draguer means both a sugared almond, so something that you give to for a first communion, but also it's the idea of a shot in a hunt, and the woodland scene suggests that idea of a hunt. The woodland scene also points to the way in which Wotton is interested in all kinds of categories of found objects and collected objects, notably natural specimens. So you see collections of butterflies there, and if you can see on the left-hand side, more of these. And you'll see in the studio, prominently placed there, Giacometti's ball, which Wotton purchased and kept in his studio right up to his death. And likewise, he also kept this little object here, which is this. And in many ways, the difficulty of some of the earlier objects with Dalí's and with Breton's seems to be addressed, I think, most successfully here. And in many ways, this is the work, out of all of the objects, this is the work that seems to have the most sense of kind of completeness and harmony about it. Harris suggests that it has the quality of a kind of wish image. He points out the way in which there's, like the Giacometti suspended ball, there's a similar kind of undecidability of gender. But what's clear here is this notion of encounter, an encounter which is both erotic and intensely emotional and a loving engagement as well. And indeed, in this particular period, Valentin Hugo, who's a member of the Surrealist group, a little bit older than Breton, Hugo is in love with Breton. And Breton, who's just recovering from his failed relationship with Suzanne Musard, Breton stays friends with Hugo but isn't able to reciprocate. So there's a story here that gives a background to this encounter that is played out through the idea of touch and eroticism. There's a notion of the idea of chance, Mallarmé's line from his poem, a roll of the dice never abolishes chance. So the idea of chance is specifically referred to here in this gaming board and the dice, and the two gloves with their subtle erotic and fetishistic encounter. And last but not least, Gala's object, which once again one might expect to occur in a kind of arena of an emerging relationship, a relationship which is at this point is still very young with Dalí, but which, as we know, is going to be a much more successful relationship, a much more direct encounter between the two of them. In Dalí's words, two metal oscillating curved antennae, at their extremities two sponges, one metallic, the other natural, carved in the form of a breast, with two knuckle bones dipped in carmine to represent the nipples. When a boost is given to the antennae, one of the above-mentioned sponges lightly brushes the flower in a bowl, and the other gently grazes the bristled points of a metallic brush. The bowl itself is installed in an inclined box containing other objects corresponding to supplementary representations, a red elastic membrane moving imperceptibly for some time. A small black flexible spiral resembling an ankle hangs from a small red cage. I'm not clear exactly where that is in here. A paintbrush made of white wood and a pharmaceutical tube divide the compartments of the box. This is the object which I'm finding hardest to kind of understand and to interpret myself. But one line of inquiry, I wonder, is to do with the kind of the deliberately kind of mechanical use of metal domestic objects, but they're, you know, specifically modern domestic objects. And I'm kind of wondering whether part of that might relate to Gala's place and kind of status within what is now a shared household. The Dalí-Gala household of the early 30s is notably not like Breton's studio, full of collections and objects in a way that's not entirely unlike Freud's collection, but is much more influenced by things like Art Deco with steel and specifically modern objects. René Crevel, writing about this, sees it as the most emotional, the most moving object. And he goes on to talk in a text that comes a little bit later but is referring to these objects. He's talking about the fact that they managed to proclaim the law of universal reciprocity that reigns over the relationship between beings, between things, from beings to things and things to beings, from the dumbest everyday to those surprises that are too light for anyone at first sight to suspect the place they'll come to occupy, from where they will radiate outwards from the hive of associations. So a collision and a collusion between the subject and the object is being enacted in these works. It seems more than likely that other objects were made as part of this game as well. We know from something that Dalí mentions later that René Crevel made an object that involved beer, Paul Éluard made something that had a candle in it, and Man Ray seems to have offered a sausage on wheels. Touch seems to be crucial to most of these objects. It might be related, amongst other things, to Dalí's interest in masturbation, and more generally to the idea of the relationships, the knuckles between ideas touching each other, their promiscuity, and emphasising the idea of a specifically hands-on game that's in great contrast to the hands-off feel of psychoanalysis and the relationship between the patient and the analyst. And this in turn connects to the centrality of play with these objects, playing with things, with making. These are non-artists making the work in several cases. Literally play that's a kind of gamble, or play that's for Breton a kind of childish play with guns and slingshots. Dalí also points to the interest in digestion, and he notes the prevalence of edible elements. And he comes eventually to see this as part of a much bigger scaffolding of object proposals that starts with the idea of dream objects and goes all the way through to the idea of automatic sculpture, where everybody's given some sort of malleable material to be made automatically that will then be collected and analysed, and eventually to making objects that could, in his words, bring about our fusion with them and make us pursue the formation of a unity with them in hunger for an article and edible articles. For Freud, in the question of lay analysis, he specifies that the struggle between the ego and the id, in Freud's word, takes into account the conditions imposed by the real external world, and it's also possible to intervene in the external world by changing it, to establish in it intentionally the conditions which make satisfaction possible. Where Freud sees this as the task of the ego, Dalí seems to see both the external world as the prime actor and think also that that world speaks not the language of the ego, but of the id. So what about analysis? Dalí's analysis, arguably, in his text, is rudimentary, both because it's partly redundant and because it might risk being reductive. Where psychoanalysis might be tempted to drill down deeper in a metaphor of archaeology, in these objects the process is of accumulation, of construction, operating outwards from memories to things. The question of symbolism is interesting here too. A symbol tends to signal a single reading, which might be the problem here, whereas in these cases, what's much more interesting is the latency, the possibility of these symbols that might generate in all kinds of directions. In retrospect, in the 1970s, Dalí would claim that these symbolically functioning objects were specifically a kind of engagement with and a sort of attack on surrealism's origins in dream and automatism. The point was, as he said, to invent an irrational object that, as concretely as possible, would translate the raving fantasies of a poetic mind. In the light of such tensions, can the surrealists be read as an analytical community? Freud's aim in the question of lay analysis, which at first sight looks like the defence of non-specialist analysts, is of course a plea that the psychoanalyst need not necessarily be a doctor, but must have a laborious, long-term specialist training. So we're not talking about amateur analysis. But he also lays out the basis, Freud lays out the basis, for what a college of psychoanalysis might have to teach. Some of these are medical specialisms: depth psychology, biology, the science of sexual life, the symptomatology of psychiatry. And others are quite different: the history of civilization, mythology, the psychology of religion, the science of literature. I would argue that the surrealists as a community have all of these experiences and more, not in the arena of the consulting room or the clinic, but in collaborative play. I'm going to leave you with just one last coda to suggest that this convergence of the object of play and analysis in surrealist practice happens in 1931, a particular time and place, but also continues in surrealist practice, not just in France, but elsewhere. In Bucharest in the 1940s, where objects are bestowed upon colleagues as irrational gifts, in a game which has its origin in a psychiatric case study. And the Bucharest surrealists have some interesting things to say about the relationship between latent and manifest. They think that latent is a waste of time and everything's manifest. Pierre Mabille, the surrealist theorist and writer, who also comes from a medical background, was one of the people who helped develop the so-called village test, which is part of what's now known, I gather, as sand play therapy, So the participant is meant to construct an imaginary village, and then that would be interpreted. Or the Czech surrealist group in the 1980s, who, materializing ideas about sexual practices with the use of objects, create this collaborative object along with explanatory texts and interpretations. The encounter between the object, the play, and analysis continues right through surrealism throughout its history. Thanks very much.